Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today is Friday. It's December 3rd, and it's 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. Well, we're going to start the day with none other than Nader Sayers, Esquire. He's a New York State Assemblyman representing District 90, which is comprised totally of the city of Yonkers. And he'll be on in the first hour. And in the second hour, we're going to speak to Richard Thomas, former Mount Vernon mayor. We talk to him about governance as well. There are a lot of very interesting things that have happened of late, but constantly, you know, that's the job of the New York State Assembly member. And he's been involved in quite a few issues. Bear with me a moment as I move on to that because he's not on the on the line yet. So bear with me a moment here. Where is it here? Okay. Well, one of the things that's really, really quite interesting, and I really didn't think that this would come about so soon, but evidently many people who are in elected office, particularly assembly members, senators, as well as mayors in Westchester County, have already come out and endorsed none other than Kathy Hochul, the present governor, for re-election to a full term. So, and the elected officials are from Rockland and Westchester counties, and you've got really unbelievable names that are just huge. We've got Assemblymember Amy Paulin representing District 88. Of course, Assemblymember Nader Sayers, who represents District 90, we're going to talk to him. Assemblymember Steve Otis of District 91. Assemblymember Chris Burdick, District 93. Assemblymember Sandy Galef of District 95. And Assemblymember Ken Dombrowski, District 96. We've got New Rochelle Mayor Noam Bramson, White Plains Mayor Thomas Roach, Yonkers Mayor Mike Spano. These are unbelievable names and extremely supportive, which is amazing. And so I'm thrilled to hear that because I'm just, you know, astounded by her capacity from the moment that she got on. Well, the assembly member is on, so let's pull him in. Good morning, assembly member. Nader Sayers, how are you, sir?
Good, Hezzy. Always a pleasure. It's a pleasure to be on the show and to be involved. Always happy whenever we have an opportunity to talk about issues and disseminate information. It's a win-win for the public. So it's a pleasure to be on, buddy.
Thanks so much. Well, thank you. Well, I was just pointing out before you came on, there are a lot of people, assembly members and senators and mayors and people in government that have already come out to support Governor Hochul for a completely full four-year term because she came in the last few months, you know, to supplant Governor Cuomo, who's under federal as well as other investigations. What did you see in Governor Hochul that caused you to come out and endorse her so early in the campaign? Or is it early, or is it already late, you know, to be endorsing?
No, honestly, the timing is probably now. Usually, whenever there's an upcoming election, and in this case, you're looking at a primary for governor that will take place in June this coming year. So you're not far away. June 2022 is really around the corner. You're talking about 6-7 months and for a governor's race. This is probably the right time. Usually after the fall elections that we just had in November, you know, is the time when people start either putting out their names for potential candidacies or reruns. Mm. And in this case, the governor who took over for the former governor really you know, has done a lot of good. You know, she's been extremely visible. She's been here to Yonkers a number of times, to our county. And then, you know, you realize in her capacity, her former capacity as a lieutenant governor, she visited every one of the 62 counties in New York State each and every year. For someone who's a lieutenant governor candidate or in that position, historically, they're really just names. You know, they're not active. Most governors look at their lieutenant governors just to balance their tickets when they run or rerun for election. In this case, Governor Kathy Hochul, in my opinion, really exhibited, you know, not only a record of activity and visibility, but, you know, was very passionate when it came to the storm, Ida, very passionate and compassionate when she took on initiatives to fight, you know, gun violence and crime prevention initiatives. So for me to witness that, you know, won me over, you know, and I represent the city of Yonkers. We're the third largest city in the state of New York. So we really play a big role in Westchester County and, in my opinion, in state politics. You know, we're a cross-section of New York City and Mid-Hudson, and so we're more reflective. You know, here in Yonkers, I feel
but you know,
that
we... Go ahead, finish your thought. Sorry.
Thank you. We're reflective of the state, you know, when it comes to representing urban and suburban populations. Yonkers is a mixed bag. You know, we feel that, you know, the direction Yonkers goes, I think the state goes. And in this case, my endorsement of Kathy Hochul for governor is really not to compare her to other potential candidates, because honestly, I have a lot of respect for all the other candidates that are involved. But I feel that the governor, you know, needs to be given an opportunity. She's the first woman elected governor in New York, and we really don't have reason to say she doesn't deserve another opportunity. The state organization, Democrat Party, practically unanimously endorsed her along with the state chairman. So, you know, for me as a legislator representing Yonkers, my opinion was she deserves an opportunity, and that's why I joined with a number of other assembly members from the Mid-Hudson and mayors representing the biggest cities in Westchester County to come out and endorse Governor Kathy Hochul.
Well, one thing is interesting. I never realized that she was there, even though she visited all the communities in the state. And what I found interesting was her demeanor. I guess it's informed by the fact that she is a woman, but she's very powerful, very astute, and she brought a new sensibility, which I thought was much more attuned to the entire state. Very involved, very engaged, and I was surprised from my perspective, maybe because of my ignorance, I never realized that she was there because she was hidden by Governor Cuomo, who just like sucked the air out of the room and never gave her an opportunity to shine as a partner. And at least that's part of my ignorance or my lack of sensitivity. But I was very impressed when she came over. She took control and she followed through. And there was no equivocation about her capacity. And I think that's very impressive. I don't know if all women are like that or that she just has a way about her, which I think is as strong as, but a lot more comfortable to accept her perspectives, maybe because she's a little bit softer in tone as opposed to being almost autocratic, even though Cuomo probably wouldn't agree. But and then he's under unbelievable scrutiny. My God, I had no idea that the federal government is looking into his conduct, and of course the New York State Attorney General. My goodness, unbelievable.
It is unbelievable.
I'm very quite I'm quite impressed by her.
Yeah, well, she you're right. You know, as a woman, you know, she was able to show compassion. She was able to show leadership, even with some of the major issues confronting our state. You know, she was very, very strong publicly in her messaging, but she did it in a way where, you know, she showed, you know, hey, you know, let's move slowly on it. Let's not panic. Even recently with the press conferences she had with regards to this new Omicron variant, you know, she was calm about it. You know, she said, look, let's not panic. You know, let's be careful. Let's move forward. Let's continue to monitor. And that's what I like. You know, to me, when someone panics in government, it causes widespread panic among the general public. And we don't want leaders that, you know, either, you know, intentionally or unintentionally scare us into believing that, you know, danger is in front of us and so forth. But if you listen, if you saw her in her press conference, you know, with a very, you know, well-mannered approach, you know, with a smile on her face, you know, to really say, hey, you know, we have an issue here, let's deal with it, but let's study it, let's not close down the state, let's not panic. And that's what people wanted to hear. I mean, people were really fearful. Here we go again. It's a fall. It's getting cold. You know, people right away panicked about canceling holiday festivities and do we now stay home? And that would be a devastation for the industry, the businesses, the restaurants, the movie theaters. Mm-hmm. You know, so many of us in government looking at this, here we are the last year, you know, pushing the economy and trying to recover from the harm of the pandemic over the last couple of years. And then, you know, to be hit with, you know, the urgency of this Omicron variant, you know, and how it's impacted Europe and the closure of Europe and what's happening in Germany and Greece and elsewhere in South Africa, you know, was alarming for many of us.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I wanted to ask you about something else. You were able to deliver $100,000 for police training in Yonkers. How did that come about?
Well, you know, if you recall, and we spoke on this show, Hezzy, numerous times about, you know, what took place the last 2 years, not only in New York, but really the entire country with the polarization, with the Floyd matter. If you recall, there was extensive attacks and questions about law enforcement as a profession, and there was even a call for a defunding police and so forth. Yeah. Early on, during that period, I made it very clear at the time that, you know, I really did not believe that the answer, the solution was defunding police. I really felt that the law enforcement profession in our country, and here in Yonkers, you know, to a large extent has been extremely successful. And not to say that there wasn't wrongdoings, you know, each and every one of us that witnessed the George Floyd film and video was extremely upset and hurt that this was uncalled for. It was extreme, unnecessary force that resulted in the Floyd death. And there was a need to revise and reform and train law enforcement across the country. So I took the position of saying, hey, at that time, you know, let's not blame the profession. And those that blame the profession and forced legislation and public media and perception against law enforcement, we witnessed in those communities a rise in crime. And many of us said, hey, that directly was an attack on law enforcement. It really demoralized the law enforcement profession. And whether we liked it or not, many in the law profession chose to back off in many instances, in my opinion, potential conflicts that resulted in loss of life and death. So for that reason, I took the initiative to look into, you know, what can we do to improve law enforcement? And the main issues, as I saw, involved a need for more transparency, which we demanded and got a lot of communications from police commissioners and others that supported more transparency. We wanted diversity in hiring to make sure that the face of cops and law enforcement people that are being hired on every level is reflective of the communities they serve. And we also felt that law enforcement needed training. And that's where I came in. I issued a $100,000 grant from the New York State Assembly that I lobbied for and gave that grant. Recently, this week, we had a major press conference with Commissioner John Mueller of the Yonkers Police Department and many other elected officials and leaders. And we provided the grant that will initiate a new training program called ICAT, which stands for Integrating Communications, Assessment, and Tactics. This is a training program that is primarily focused on diffusing critical incidents. It's like a de-escalation. In most cases, law enforcement officials will say to us, hey, we're confronted with many situations where the person who's out of order may not have a gun. You know, they may have another weapon. They may have a bottle. They may have a knife. They may have something else. But there's potentially distress going on. There's mental illness. So how does a law enforcement official, or what training can we give them to de-escalate that situation so that it doesn't result in either a law enforcement official getting hurt or the person involved being hurt or potentially killed? And this program was a model we looked at in Louisville, Kentucky, where in every category there was like triple digit, you know, success in reducing incidents, reducing arrests, reducing the loss of life. And it was such a wonderful, effective program that working with Commissioner Mueller, we decided, hey, let's do this in Yonkers. And Yonkers can provide this training to all of its 611 officers. And not only a training that's district-wide, but this is specially geared to doing the training at every police precinct. This way, men and women, law enforcement officials at the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th precinct in Yonkers can be trained to de-escalate in these incidents and conflicts. And I would love for this to be a model that goes beyond Yonkers for people in other parts of our state and communities and even nationally to say, hey, this is really a terrific program, and maybe rather than defunding, let's provide more training to law enforcement. Let's give them the resources they need and motivate them to do their jobs the right way and really address, you know, what the issues are in policing skills and strategies. Yonkers already has a police community advisory board that I think is necessary. And I think that, you know, we as legislators, as community leaders, as public safety people, we need to look at what are the best models, what are the best strategies that we can put together that makes law enforcement and the law enforcement profession more efficient, more effective. You know, as an educator, we did this in education. You know, we look at the best strategies to teach children, special education, English language learners, people with disabilities. And we look at the best strategies. We try to teach our teachers. We try to train them, our principals, our central office people. And that's the way we do it in every profession. In healthcare, it's no different. You know, where doctors have to do continuing medical education and lawyers have to do continuing legal education. And the law enforcement profession shouldn't be any different. Let's develop a law enforcement continued education or training that gives them the latest technologies, the latest skills, so that they know how to de-escalate, how to avoid a conflict going from, you know, a low level to a high level that results in a serious injury and harm to the community at large.
Do you see that there's is there any oversight to all of this? You know, the funding of $100,000, has the police department given you a template of how they expect to get this done?
Yes.
You know, everything
well, the program starts in January. We already, you know, have been invited to participate, to witness the training, because as a legislator, you're right. I don't want just to give a grant and then, well, I gave them the grant, we did a press conference, it looks good. I want to follow up. And the arrangements were made with the cooperation of the police commissioner for myself and my staff to be involved, to witness the training, to see the training firsthand, to see how the officers react. And, you know, and what I would do there is I would question the officers and say, hey, did you learn from this? How effective was this? Similar to what I would do when I was a principal for 30-plus years.
Right.
You know,
anytime
my teachers went to training or workshops, I sat with them and I said, look, how did it go? And I participated in the training, so I knew firsthand, you know, what it was all about, whether it really was meaningful, whether it was worthy. And honestly, over the years, many training programs afterwards, you know, we made a decision that, you know, this is not really efficient or it's not working or it's not worth the value of what we paid for it. And we stopped it. And many of it was so successful that we called fellow principals, we called other leaders in other school districts.
Well, that's the whole point. You know, the point is that with the police department, they're not very open about what they do. Will there be figures to substantiate the use of such a grand an investment? You're investing in our police department. Are they going to be able to show us figures that say, hey, this has been very successful?
Well, that's the key. I mean, we already looked at the results in the Louisville, Kentucky model, and in categories that were crucial, you know, we've witnessed anywhere from 20% to 30% of, you know, de-escalation and conflicts in the death or injury of citizens.
That's
in that
great.
Community.
So does that mean that every police officer will get training for this, or will this be
every,
a particular group
every,
of police
every,
that will be trained and specific for an event?
611.
I mean, do you call that special police?
Really? Yeah, no,
all 611? Wow.
All 611 at the four precincts would be given the training. And I'm impressed with it. And I'm looking forward, you know, to reaching out as I have in the past to police commissioners and sheriffs and other communities that we have an open dialogue with. And we're using that dialogue, by the way, to look at, you know, policing, not only policing skills and training and strategy. We're also looking at, you know, the bail reform. We're looking at the criminal justice reform that our state has initiated the last couple of years.
Yeah, but that's nothing to do with the grant. So, you know, that's a completely different issue.
Well, it is. It's completely.
I'm concerned about the money being wasted and as opposed to being engaged in a credible way, because I hope that you do follow through and get numbers and figures to substantiate this investment in a city that has really been mum about what goes on in the police department. They do not report.
Well, you know that I agree with you, and you know that we've had many discussions about not only this issue,
but
supplant
that,
you know,
because you go beyond that and you offer them an opportunity. You're giving them a leg up, which is phenomenal.
We've made this clear from the onset. You know, not only is a grant being provided, we want to witness, we want to follow up, we want to look at the data, we want to look at the resources, and we want to be able to see the effectiveness. So even though we see the effectiveness in other communities in America, I want to see the effectiveness in Yonkers. And you know what? If we see the effectiveness, then I'm going to be a cheerleader to go and lobby in my capacity as a state representative to other law enforcement officials and to provide more statewide funding for similar initiatives and to convince people like the governor and the speaker of the assembly and the majority leader of the Senate that, hey, this should be mandatory funding and mandatory training for law enforcement officials throughout the state of New York. It shouldn't be just,
well,
you know, for Yonkers and elsewhere.
I used to always hear that they get training at the with the police in the police department. They go to Valhalla for training, except that when they come out, they're deficient because they don't have the training. So you are really infusing a sensitivity and a sensibility and a capacity for them to get the training that they don't get in Valhalla, which is really quite unique. And by this in this grant, you know, Yonkers can take the lead in all of Westchester County and cause even our Westchester police to function on a better level. You know, we don't need to have people killed. Remember that guy Chamberlain, who by accident pressed his, you know, some sort of an alert thing that he had on his chest, and then he said that it was a mistake, but then the White Plains police knocked the door down and they killed him. And there was no reason for that sort of thing.
There wasn't. This is a type of an event that we feel through this, you know, what they call critical decision-making model that allows police officers, you know, to collect information, assess situations, threats, and risk, consider police powers, agency, identify options, determine the best course of action, act, review, and reassess. And this is like a cycle. Law enforcement departments and officials, you know, need to be taught, you know, how to assess information, how to determine, you know, from the circumstances what the options or actions that they can undertake. And and it's been successful. It's a decision-making model, you know, that is part of this program, part of this training. And I really feel, I feel good about it, Tezzy. And to your point, you know, we're already tied into the follow-up and tied into witnessing the training and already
comforted by that. I want you to know I'm very comforted by it because I've heard, you know, a great deal of verbosity from one person to the next, but at the end of the day, there's nothing there. It's just like, you know, a great press notice. But I know with you focusing on it, it's going to matter. And
you know,
if there needs to be a correction, I know that your staff will be able to make that.
Well, that's the key. You got to be proactive. Like a lot of these situations involve people with mental illness and disabilities. And, you know, we spoke in prior shows about, you know, from my end, identifying a serious problem that involves people with autism. And we put up legislation where, you know, we're looking to make sure that law enforcement people can identify, you know, drivers, for example, that have autism. You know, even the potential, it's still being reviewed, but to have some sort of a label on driver license of people with autism so that when a police officer stops someone, you know, driving who has autism, we know that with autism, sometimes people with autism have an attention span issue. Sometimes they have a difficult time following directives. And very often if a police officer doesn't know that and is not trained to address people with autism, they may get very upset and tension may rise because how can
is that going to be on their license? So is there going to be some sort of intrusion into their needing to divulge that? Supplant that in a positive way?
Well, the way the legislation, it would be voluntary. So you know, some people,
okay.
You're right. Some people are saying, you know what, I don't want people to know I have autism. But
right.
If somebody, for example, has autism, and we see this all the time, you know, they leave high school, their families want them to be productive, they want them to get a
mm-hmm.
job, they want them to drive, right? But there's always a fear that, you know, if they drive and get stopped, they're going to get arrested or beat up because, you know, technically the officer thinks they're not complying or following the commands,
mm-hmm.
or are they going to, you know, so should we leave them home? And, you know, and I'm pushing legislation,
you know, I'm wondering,
or,
you know,
and awareness.
I'm wondering, though, if there's a better way. Is there a way when a police officer stops someone who may be suffering from autism, that when they ask for the driver's license and they look up to see, you know, a record, it's there at the record that's secure, and that they could find out that they do suffer from autism, so that the police officer will have a better attitude about it. And yet the divulging that to anybody who sees the license, it's none of their business necessarily, but it is the business of a police officer, so he can interact in a better way. That would be
correct.
Wonderful if you could do that. You protect their identity, but at the same time reveal it to the police.
Well, you know, the problem is normally police officers in most cases are not digging into somebody's records and background. If they stop someone, if they're on the cell phone, if they feel they're not
uh-huh.
driving right or whatever. So to avoid getting to that level where they have to go and look into a person's record, you know, if
uh-huh.
and again, it's voluntary, where a person can say, yeah, you know, I want a symbol
okay.
on my driver's license, so that automatically the police officer's trained, hey, I'm dealing with a person with autism. Let me at
mm-hmm.
least, you know, be patient, you know, listen, hear the person out, understand that if they come across as being uncooperative, it's not intentional, they don't mean it, it's their condition.
Okay.
And that de-escalates. I mean, that's what we're talking about. Any way we can train officers to de-escalate conflicts and provide, not that we're saying every officer has to be a psychologist, a social worker. You know, a lot of times officers would say,
hey, if they get the training, that's great. We're not looking for, you know, psychologists and psychiatrists. You know, that's something completely different. Well, and, you know, I want to get on to something else that you were engaged in, and you're talking about, you know, getting the accreditation for, what is it, MGM, to get a licensing for casino gambling. How does that look? Does it look like Yonkers might get it, because it will affect the entire metropolitan area?
Well, I think you know, we have a very, very good prognosis. I really have to
uh-huh.
say that, you know, last few weeks back, we had that major press conference at, you know, Yonkers Raceway at MGM.
Right.
And, you know, it was a cross-section of political representatives from every level of government, from not only
mm-hmm.
Yonkers, but the entire Westchester County, even New York
right.
City, the Bronx
yep.
delegation on the Senate level, the Assembly, were completely involved, the business community, because they all recognize that the importance of MGM getting this downstate license where they can have sport betting, table gambling. And
yeah.
the recognition was, as I said at the press conference, is that, you know, 40% of New York's revenue, New York State, 40% of our revenue goes to New Jersey that's presently in sport betting. You
right.
know, so my position is, you know, keep the money in New York. You know, that project you know, would result in 10,000 new jobs, you know, good paying jobs. The impact on the economy of Yonkers,
new jobs.
Really? I mean, this is impressive. Good paying jobs where people can raise their families. Many of those jobs would go to Yonkers residents, Westchester, Bronx residents. And, you know, in my opinion, the entire economy of the area, they would, you know, MGM is looking to do, you know, an expansion of what we now know is, you know, the Empire Casino, the Yonkers Raceway.
Right.
They're looking to expand into an entertainment center right there. They have the property to put forth this big sport entertainment center. You know, the amount of revenue that would be generated in taxes and the economic growth is unbelievable. And I want that to come to Yonkers. I want the amount of money that historically came from Empire Casino to be doubled, you know, that goes to the Yonkers schools. We know historically we received $19.6 million. I'd like to see that jump to $30 million or $40 million and really address a serious shortfall that, you know, I've been fighting for, you know, for Yonkers education. I always felt the funding formula was inequitable. It doesn't give Yonkers the money it deserves. Yonkers kids get shortchanged. We lose support services. We lose special ed funds, funds for counselors and social workers and psychologists.
Right.
And I've always said, when people talk to me about the homeless situation or crime in our community and state, a lot of it results back to the lack of proper support services, proper job training, development, proper services to make sure all our high school kids graduate with a high school diploma, those that go to colleges. That's the source of a lot of our problems. And when I speak to the governor and I speak to others, I, you know, as an educator, I stress the importance of making sure that there's an ample amount of funding for job training programs to address homelessness, mental illness support service programs, drug addiction programs. That's really being proactive. That's going to the source of what an issue is and not trying to say, if I want to help somebody who's homeless and I give them an apartment, that doesn't solve their problem. Most of the time, if you don't address their initial concerns that caused the homelessness, they're going to end up back in the streets again. You know, so
you know what
I
they're doing on Southern Boulevard in the Bronx, which is very interesting, that a lot of people who may be suffering from PTSD of some sort, not every incident of PTSD happens on the in a war situation.
Correct.
But there are other circumstances that bring this about as well. But in order to re-engage an individual that's suffering of these things, quite often they need medication. They need a job. And on Southern Boulevard, what they did was they had new buildings, new construction, small maybe, you know, small studio apartments that they built. And then every individual has to come down and can't leave the facility unless they take their medication through the concierge. And then the concierge also gets them appointments for training, for a job, and, you know, rebuilds, you know, a person's self-worth. But these programs are out there, but we've never had that in Yonkers. And then every time you say to somebody, well, what did you do with this homeless population? Well, we've got places for them. How many more places do you have? We don't have any because they're full. So that means maybe you need to build this stuff.
Well, you're right. And, you know, there's programs that we know, as, you know, we spoke earlier about the model for a de-escalation of, you know, for police. And there's also programs that in the Bronx, as you've mentioned, Hezzy, that extremely work well because they're applying what we're talking about, you know, the initial needs, in many cases medication if it's drug addiction, right. You know, to give them the services they need to hopefully get them off drug addiction and back into productivity and get them a job and so forth. And with the economy and the infrastructure, you know, I see an era whereas in our nation, assuming the, you know, the multi-trillion-dollar infrastructure bills are passed by the Senate and the Congress, I see the country being put on path to what most of us in history recall in the New Deal days when Franklin Roosevelt, you know, wanted to, you know, generate economic growth in America, and he focused on the New Deal that focused on building bridges and schools and dams and roads and railroads, and that energized our nation. The amount of jobs that provided at that time many poor middle class and immigrant families with employment opportunities. I see this happening again, you know, and many of us are realizing that our nation needs this. I mean, you know, we haven't rebuilt bridges or dams or roads. Yeah, some of them are over 100 years old.
I understand all that, except is there legislation to make sure that we hire locally? Like, for example, in Elmsford, which is our neighbor here in Westchester County, we've got Teamsters unions, and yet we don't engage them when, God forbid, there's a storm and they need to take care of the wires that have fallen or trees that need to be moved. And we wait 10 days for these bozos to come all the way from Louisiana because they're a little bit cheaper. Waiting 10 days for them to arrive costs us more.
Well,
is there a way to get legislation to change that? Why can't we use them here from New York?
Well, there is legislation.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah, we have legislation with a package of utility bills, for example. You know, with the storms, as you mentioned, we often said that utility companies like Con Ed and others, and even major businesses in our neighborhood like UPS and others that are coming into Yonkers and Westchester and the region, we're saying to them, as part of the discussions, you want our cooperation, you want to come, yes, we welcome economic growth, we welcome new businesses, but we want you to protect the integrity of the communities you're coming into, whether it's noise pollution. And as you said, you know, we met with representatives of UPS, for example, and we made a big issue about initially a concern that they were not hiring local labor. So, you know, we worked very closely with labor organizations, and we changed the policy and really developed dialogue that focused on how we can work together closer. Utility companies with storms, you're right, one of the biggest concerns was because it was cheaper, they were bringing in crews to repair power lines and drop wires and other concerns from other states because, it was cheaper. And we said, you know what? The legislation we have demands that within 24 hours, especially to hospitals, to emergency services, to police, to fire, that there's an adequate, time frame that they have to have power sources and generators. This tells the utility companies, you know, you better realize that the Public Service Commission, it's not like the old days where, we get fined $1 million, it's a pocket change for them, so we'll just continue to save money. No, now it's going to be...
In New York City, if there's an outage of electricity, which everybody uses electricity for the same purposes, for air conditioning, for electrical appliances, for oxygen, for patients who need that in their homes, and also for refrigeration. And a lot of people have insulin at the home, and it needs to be kept cool, and so on and so forth. But interestingly enough, in New York City, Con Ed paid for spoiled food, for spoiled medication, and in Westchester County, it was only this past year that they started to
Correct.
Compensate people for these losses.
And
now,
they gave them a hard
catch
time.
Up? A
exactly.
very hard time.
Well,
and Con Ed
well,
wasn't fined for it.
No. That's why, you know, this last storm that we
yeah.
had, I was driving down the Como Tappan Zee Bridge, and
right.
the night before the storm, you know, because we knew the storm was
uh-huh.
coming, and
right.
and a smile came on my face, Hezzy, because there was because there was utility trucks, you know, that were driving. Really, you know, by my car. So I'm going over the bridge from Rockland to Westchester, and there was these utility
yeah.
company trucks, you know, coming into Westchester County. And that was the type of proactive action that we always wanted utility companies. If we know there's a major storm coming, you got to wait till there's down wires and trees. You know, get your act together. Be proactive. You know, and that was a sign that they were being proactive. So honestly,
mm-hmm.
I think that over the last couple of years, and a lot of it is because of legislation that has been sponsored, and I'm proud to say that, you know, I put forth some 6 to 8 bills involving specifically utility companies and power shortages
uh-huh.
and making sure that, you know, police and fire and ambulance services are protected, and also for
mm-hmm.
people that are old or healthcare or nursing homes or people with
right.
disabilities, because many of them rely on electricity. Imagine their power
mm-hmm.
gets cut off and they can't walk and they can't, you know, have their sometimes medical devices functioning because
right.
of a lack of generators. It's a big issue, and you know, we needed the foresight to look at an issue involving utilities, economic development, law enforcement, education. That's what legislation, effective legislation, is all about. It's having the foresight
Correct.
To not only see a problem, but to really dig into how do we resolve it. We spoke earlier about MGM. You know, we have
mm-hmm.
this coming Wednesday in Albany, a race and wagering hearing taking place in Albany. And I'm proud
really?
That over the last year I've been a member of the race and wagering committee. And I plan to be in Albany. We're going to be up there this Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday dealing
mm-hmm.
with basically getting preparations going for the new session that starts in January and
right.
potentially looking at many areas of legislation that may need to be revised or new areas where new policy, new laws. And I often tell the listening audience that my role as an assemblyman is to represent the city of Yonkers in Albany. And my job,
mm-hmm.
we're the part of government where the first level or first step in changing laws and policy takes place in the assembly. And if, for
Correct.
Example, someone has a good recommendation to change a policy, change a law, a procedure, you know, they can reach out. And I'll be more than glad. God knows how many bills we've sponsored and co-sponsored, you know, a very, very important pieces of legislative change that would be beneficial, whether it involves utility companies or banking.
Well,
let
me just stop you there
things.
For 1 second. So since you broached this topic, so how do people reach out to your office?
Well,
they
can always
– idea.
Of course. No, you know, we have, by the way, a weekly newsletter that we send out
yeah.
online. And I often tell, you know, we give it, you know, right now there's about 7,000 to 8,000 people that receive the newsletter. And, you know, my goal is to keep up in that. I'd love, you know, to bring it up to 25,000 and more, though, so that people that receive the email would understand what's going on locally in Albany, what policy, what benefits, you know, during
mm-hmm.
the unemployment, during the pandemic, during the Hurricane Ida, during vaccination. People were given information as to how to get these services. And if they have difficulty, the office can help them with their applications, their claims, and so forth. So they can always call the office at 914-779-8805. We also have an email, and the email is Sayegh, my last name, S-A-Y-E-G-H, my first initial N, SayegN at nyassembly.gov. So the email, Sayegh, S-A-Y-E-G-H-N at nyassembly.gov. And if you contact the office, give them the email. This way, your contact information, give them the email. They'll put you on our weekly email list. This way, you get all special postings about happenings, about situations that they should be concerned about.
Oh, I wanted to ask you about one last thing because we're down to the last 10 minutes. You know, we recognize the disparate definitions of how people look at themselves. So we have, of course, people who are black. We have people who are Hispanic. We have people who are, white. And then we have women. We have men. We have gays. We have straights. We have people who don't know exactly where they are, or they're deciding. But what about Middle Easterners? How come we're only lumped in with only white people? And when do we get recognized as different? And we have different histories, and we have different heritages, and we have different religions, and so on and so forth. Can that come about where we're recognized?
Well, you know, you bring up a very valid point, as the, too often, and, you know, we see it in data collected by the federal government, state, local, even school data, where, you know, we have categories that involve African-Americans and Latinos or Hispanics. You have categories that define American Indians and Asians and so forth. One area of category, and it's true that, you know, people from the Middle East are lumped in into the category of white. And you can have somebody from the Middle East, from, Arab-speaking countries, or Israeli, or Turkish, or Persian, and they're all people of the Middle East. And very often, you know, they're, for example, a growing community here in not only Yonkers, but New York State. And, our goal as legislators is to really try to make sure that government is inclusive, that whatever we do involves all different people and give the opportunity to every individual out there to have equity in services and opportunities. And when you're talking about Middle Easterners, you know, it's come to my attention that, you know, there's many instances where there's really a lack of proper representation of people of Middle East background, and it's because they're not identified as a category in their own. And it came to my attention recently with a young lady who was a candidate for a federal bench. This is an appointment made by, you know, by the Senate, and the majority leader, Senator Chuck Schumer, of course, plays a key role in that. And it came to my attention, a woman by the name of Judge Odessa Kennedy serves as a New York City civil court judge. And she's been nominated for what they call the federal bench to be a federal justice. And, I wrote on her behalf, and I appreciated the fact that, you know, she's of Persian background. You know, her family fled Iran during the Iranian Revolution. She's been outstanding, published, 30 or more major decisions, serves in New York City, some of the busiest courts in the nation, and really highly, highly qualified, when you look at her, she falls into the category of white because of her Persian background. But, when you look at how many people of Middle Eastern or Islamic faith serve on the federal bench. You don't have any. If you look at the Middle East as a category, you know, then it provides an opportunity for individuals from the Middle East, you know, that are American citizens, of course, and, you know, who've had a credible background and career here in America to be given those opportunities. So that's a point well taken, and we'll be reaching out, you know, through potentially state legislation or reaching out to the federal delegation, to the U.S. senators and our congressional representatives to look at that and say, hey, there's a potential issue, there's a concern, it can really alleviate an important matter. What do we say? We look at legislation to address it. Similar to what's happening with the SALT, you know, the SALT, the $10,000 restriction, finally, it was approved by the Congress to lift that SALT restriction of $10,000. That was something President Trump, you know, placed on many urban states. I'm not sure if that was a punishment to Democrat states, but it really hurt a tremendous amount of New Yorkers, a tremendous amount of people in my district in Yonkers, where, you know, the average person is paying a lot more than $10,000 in taxes. So, you know, when they're restricted to being able to deduct up to $10,000 max, that's a serious hardship for many property owners that are already suffering with high taxes and high fuel costs and the cost of living. It's really unfair. Right. So many of us have been lobbying very hard, our federal delegation, to say, hey, with any new package for the infrastructure and for a new package of stimulus and whatever, let's make sure we throw in there a removal of that $10,000 limitation. Mm-hmm. From what I hear, it's gradually being removed. It may be increased to $25,000, which at least brings a lot of relief to many property owners, homeowners in my community, in my county. Mm-hmm. You know, and then, you know, you're dealing with student loans and, you know, many students that are frustrated with the high cost, many of them that are, you know, we're a society that encourages our young people go to colleges, get educated, get careers. And many of them that may even choose a career, let's say, in healthcare and medicine, you're talking about four-year college, many of them graduate schools, medical school 4 years, you know, anywhere from 3 to 6 year residency programs. And these individuals are graduating with close to $500,000 in loans. And then, you know, we're not giving them relief, you know. So there's talk about that. And this is another area we're lobbying government to say, you know, work with our students, you know, stop discouraging many from going into necessary professions. We're witnessing already a shortage in healthcare. We're witnessing a shortage in, you know, specialists in endocrinology, people that deal with diabetes and other heart ailments and other, you know, medical conditions. So what do we do as a society? What do we do as a nation, Hezzy? You know, we need to alert, not only alert, but identify issues that concern us, that really impact our lives, and begin to say, let's legislate. And the way to legislate is to make it more feasible to motivate young people to go into these professions, invest 10, 20 years of their lives in education so that at the end of the day, they can feel good and earn a good salary and be able to provide a necessary service, you know, and not worry about being, you know, in loans for $500,000 and they can never get out of it.
Absolutely. Well, as always, it's a pleasure and a delight to speak to you. Thank you for making the time for our audience, because it's always a learning experience. So have a great weekend. Thank you so much. I look forward to every Friday.
Well, happy for everybody listening. You know, we recently had so many Hanukkah celebrations. I wish everyone celebrated Hanukkah the very best. And, of course, Today there's like three Christmas tree lighting. Yeah, we're still lighting candles, and we're doing Christmas tree lighting throughout the city, in my neighborhood of Beech Hill, Antomaya Park, Colonial Heights. You know, so it's a good time. It's the holiday season, and we just gotta, you know, focus on good health, focus on family, focus on enjoying the holiday and being safe. Hezzy, thank you very much. Always appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you very much. All the best to
Bye-bye.
You and the family.
You too.
Take care.
Likewise.
Bye. Well, here we have it, folks. None other than Dr. Nader Sage, Esquire. He's a New York State Assemblyman representing the city of Yonkers. I think 85% of Yonkers is represented by him. He's in Assembly District 90. And the balance of what's left, the other 15% of Yonkers is represented by his fellow colleague, Gary Pretlow, who not only represents about 15% of Yonkers, but also all of Mount Vernon. So very, very exciting to say the least. Always a pleasure to speak to Nader Sage because there's so much that he does, and very humble guy. You know, may sound a little bit more gregarious than you would imagine, but he's definitely out there, definitely engaged, definitely involved, and good man, good soul, good heart, and very sensitive. And but no pushover, that's for sure. So that's something to be well said about him. Anyway, we'll soon be joined by none other than Richard Thomas. Richard Thomas is a former Mount Vernon mayor. We're going to talk to him about what impacts his thinking at the moment with regard to the city of Mount Vernon. Also, other issues that concern the restructuring, rebuilding of the state, certainly of Mount Vernon itself, and the issues that come about. We're at that cusp. We're already less than 30 days away from a new infusion of political, proponents and people that have already been elected to the Mount Vernon City Council, and we're going to see if they're going to change the demeanor and attitude and direction of a city where, instead of being adversarial as the Mount Vernon City Council to the mayor, they will be a partner with the mayor, and the mayor will be a partner to them. And by working together toward an effort that actually embellishes the city of Mount Vernon in a forward movement, they will be able to function for the benefit of Mount Vernonites. And that's very, very important because up to now, even under the Richard Thomas administration, there was a tremendous amount of pushback. I guess he was too brash for a lot of people, even though he was on target. And there was a tremendous amount of pushback, and eventually he ended up leaving government, and I think that the problem was he had no partner, and that's one of the problems in government, and it could sometimes go too far, you know, where people submit to the powers that be rather than engage in discourse and discovery of and validity to issues that confront one part of government with another. And rather than have a disparity, there needs to be conversation to bring people together. And that often is not the case, which is very, very problematic. And it's deleterious to the outcome for any particular community, whether it be a city like Mount Vernon or any other city or village or town. And it's important that people function together because you would think that that is exactly what the public had an interest in engaging when they cast their vote for a particular individual. I sometimes wonder, though, if the public is truly aware of the of how they can define people who stand before them for elected office. And I remember speaking to somebody who was running for the city council seat, and unfortunately, as far as I was concerned, they were just not qualified. And they espoused nothing, they said nothing, we were engaged in radio interviews. They absolutely didn't get it. And I'm so thankful that they, as far as I'm concerned, never made it and lost. However, the problem is that quite often we are not familiar with who these candidates are, and they believe that they can just enter government without experience, without advising of their perspective, divulging the issues that they recognize to be pertinent. If they do, you never know if they do or they don't, and what the purpose is. Is it all for monetary gain? Is that it? They think that they know enough people that will get them into political office, and then what? They're just going to collect the money? What are they going to do for it? You know, this is very, very crucial, and unfortunately, the public, as well as media, has been deficient in demanding an answer to these questions. I remember when I interviewed this individual a few times, and they said one thing, and then I said, well, how do you validate that? Oh, well, they didn't have any way to validate anything, but they just espoused things. And to me, that was outrageous. And when I challenged them, they didn't have an answer. At which point, you know, I said to myself, this is ridiculous. And I even said that on radio. Sorry, you just don't have what it takes to qualify for any particular position in government. You're making a mistake, and if anybody votes for you, it's making a mistake as well. I was outraged by the attitude that they had, and that they were not engaged and unaware of exactly what was necessary for the community they wanted to represent. Outrageous, to say the least. But you have so many people like that who just stand before us because they're good looking, whether they're male or whether they're female. It doesn't matter whether they dress well or they don't dress as well. We don't know anything. What are we voting for the outfits that they bought? That's not good enough. What do they think? What do they believe in? What do they expect to do? What do they hope for? What are they going to strive for? What are they going to deliver on? What's their position? What's their platform? Why don't we know? And why is it that as people who can elect people to office, why is it that we're unaware of exactly where they stand? And why do we accept that? Who the hell are these people to stand before us and say, cast your vote for me? On what basis? Because we like the choker you're wearing, or we like the shoes that you're wearing, or we like the pants that you're wearing, or the suit, whether it be a pantsuit or a dress suit, whatever. We like the skirt, whatever. It doesn't matter. But that's not what we're voting for. Well, maybe some people are voting for that, but that's not good enough because, you know, that doesn't translate to legislation that matters. That doesn't translate to oversight and prudent thinking and recognition of what is demanded in any community, no matter where the community is. It doesn't have to be in Westchester County. It could be in New York State, could be in New Jersey, could be in Rhode Island, could be in Mississippi or Missouri. You know, it doesn't matter. Same issues all the time, but we need to know, and we must demand that people define themselves, and if they don't have a definition of what they believe in on the first out, you know, the first time that they're out, and like in the future, well, one thing for me is this, the first question out of my mouth is, so what's your perspective? What's your position? What do you intend to bring about? And that's what I want to know. That's all I want to know. And then I'm going to ask them to give greater expression to their perspective and why they think it's relevant and also how they believe they can bring it about. All these things are the most pertinent issues in politics, and I'm not going to give anybody an easy time of it. I expect credible, respectful discourse. I expect them to divulge exactly what's on their mind, why it's on their mind, what informed them, what they intend will be the outcome, what will they fight for, and what are they going to do if, for whatever reason, they're not getting support? And how do they believe, and why do they believe, that a particular issue is pertinent to the people they wish to represent? Because let's face it, folks. There is a difference between Yonkers and New York City and Mount Vernon and Bronxville and Ossining and Tuckahoe and so on and so forth. And there is a different demeanor. You would think there wouldn't be, but there is. And each community has its own, definition of themselves, a definition of themselves that is slightly different. They're nuanced. And we have to respect that, whether we like it or not. The point is, what's not to respect? If we respect them, they'll respect us. It goes both ways. But what they do in their community matters to them and may not matter to us in the same manner. We may not even delve with those issues, or we may have already resolved those issues. But you know what? Times change. Attitudes change. Demographics change, and we need to be aware and attuned to those changes. And that's very, very pertinent. And it can't matter any differently if that's not the case. Well, unfortunately, for whatever reason, it's about 11 minutes after the hour. And Richard Thomas, who was supposed to join us, has certainly not arrived. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to cover other issues and concerns with you that will be more on the international stage, because I'm always prepared for that. I was hoping to be more local, but evidently that's not happening. This is very, very interesting. The United Arab Emirates has signed a historic deal to buy 80 French-made Rafale fighter jets. Humongous. What an unbelievable sale. The United Arab Emirates has signed a deal for 80 French-made Rafale, R-A-F-A-L-E, fighter jets, the biggest international order ever made for the war planes, officials said on Friday during a visit by French President Emmanuel Macron. The United Arab Emirates, one of the French defense industry's biggest customers, also agreed to buy 12 Caracal military transport helicopters, the French presidency said in a statement. Quote, this is an outcome of the strategic partnership between the two countries consolidating their capacity to act together for their autonomy and security, the statement had said. Well, France said the deal for the jets and helicopters is worth around, are you sitting down? 17 billion euros. French Defense Minister Florence Parly called the deal historic in a tweet and said it contributed, to, quote, directly to regional stability, end quote. Well, the Rafale order is the biggest made internationally for the aircraft since it entered into service in 2004. The agreement was signed by Dassault Aviation Director General Eric Tapie as Macron held talks with Abu Dhabi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan on the first day of a visit to the Gulf. By snapping up the Rafales built by Dassault, the United Arab Emirates is following the lead of Gulf rival Qatar, which has bought 36 of the planes, and Egypt, which ordered 24 in 2015 and 30 earlier this year. Dassault shares rose 6% on the announcement. The F-4 model planes, which are still undergoing a $2 euro development program, scheduled to be completed in 2024, will be delivered from 2027 on. The on-off negotiations for the Rafale fighter jets have been going on for more than a decade, with Abu Dhabi publicly rebuffing France's offer to supply 60 planes in 2011 as, quote, uncompetitive and unworkable, end quote. The Rafale has since made a breakthrough on the international market despite competition from the United States and other European manufacturers. It now has six foreign clients, including Qatar, India, Egypt, Greece, and Croatia. The United Arab Emirates has already the fifth biggest was already the fifth biggest customer for the French defense industry at 4.7 billion euros from 2011 to 2020, according to a parliamentary vote. And Paris has a permanent military base in the Emirati capital. Defense sources say the Rafale would replace the Mirage fleet and is unlikely to displace the American F-35 as the United Arab Emirates continues to hedge its security with two major suppliers, France and the United States. Macron's visit to the United Arab Emirates is a part of a two-day trip to the Gulf that includes stops in Qatar and Saudi Arabia. Unbelievable. Oh, well, there's our main man. He's there. Good morning, Mr. Thomas. How are you, sir? Good to have you on.
Good morning.
Well, what's on your mind? So what's happening in your world?
You know, there's a lot going on.
Tell me about it.
Brian, we got
I'm trying to keep up with it.
We got Omicron, you know, just causing all sorts of havoc in the world. Getting everybody worried because it is an extreme mutation of COVID, and it's something to really.
But so far as we know, it's not as debilitating as some of the previous incarnations of the variant. But people who have had COVID-19, a different variant. And may have been inoculated or were infected and overcame it, they are still prone to catching this variant. And yet also there's a sensibility I've read, and evidently seems to be the case where Southern Africa, where it originated, and it was actually South Africa, the Republic of South Africa, that first advised the world that they recognized this particular variant. And it was fascinating. But there's a great deal of bigotry against
right.
Southern African countries. Do you find that appropriate? Because I personally don't. Because there's nothing you could do to change the demographic. It's a variant, and the point is, you can't stop traffic. What are you going to do? Stop South African Airways to fly to Portugal or to Royal KLM to fly to Amsterdam and beyond and so on and so forth? I mean, how does this stop? And I think there are over 20 countries that now have it. Can you imagine? In 2 weeks' time, it's spread all over the world. Is that South Africa's fault?
No. I mean, look, I think it's clear, and I think the people know that it started – it didn't start, let's say, in Africa. It came from another location, and it made its way to Africa.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And I think that, you know, Africa is getting, you know, a really bad rap and being blamed for something that – you know, it wasn't even their fault. I mean, at the end of the day, we all know that COVID started in China, and it's from China. So that's it. Like, we need China to do a lot more than what it's doing.
Isn't it because a lot of people don't recognize COVID began, I think everyone believes it did originate in China, in Wuhan. However, the fact that people are not inoculated causes some people who get infected with whatever variant is out there, they the variant, whatever they got infected with, whether it be Delta or something else, mutates because these people didn't have an inoculation. So they're susceptible to that, and it mutates in them. Why aren't we, or why can't we engage in some sort of demand that people get inoculated? And what causes people not to be inoculated? I don't understand that.
So I'm going to give a two-part answer. One,
all right.
As it goes for people that have not received or chose not to get the vaccine, you know, they people have concerns. They are concerned about what are the long-term impacts and effects of this on their body, on their person, and in their questions. So that's up to them. It may be a faith-based position that they take that we should respect. But but for some, you know, like me, I look at it, I'm like, all right, I think I may be healthy, but I don't want to take the chance of, you know, fighting a mutant virus on my own. So I believe in science, believe that it's safe, and I believe it's safe for adults. But as for young people, kids, you know, under 12, I get really concerned because it's not clear as to what the real impact of this, you know, new type of vaccine will have on our children. And for adults,
doesn't that speak to the fact that somehow or another the message that's coming from the CDC is not clear, and they don't really respond to all these issues that you bring up right now and others have brought up as well?
And this is why I'm proud of the step that President Biden has taken. Mm-hmm. If we go back in time, going back to 2020 when we started talking about this stuff, Hezzy, and I've published positions on this saying testing is the answer, period. The United States needs have a wartime response in terms of rapid testing. There's no excuse not having access to at-home COVID test kits for everybody, especially people that are not vaccinated. This is how you help people make a decision, and this is how you help people make, you know, choices that are appropriate for them. So if you have reliable rapid tests, which are available, if you make them more accessible, then guess what? People will do a better job at determining whether or not they either A, have COVID, or B, they don't. And that's what we need. So I'm proud of it. As ordered,
one of the problems is that, let's say, if you want to get a test, do you need to get tested every week? That's not going to be cheap. How can people afford that?
Disagree. The cost to make a rapid test is very much similar to the cost of a can of soda. It is
okay.
Yeah, but on the wholesale price, the business side of it, this is where, you know, the government has to tell the private industry, we're going to give you a certain amount of profit. We need to contain and control this virus and pandemic. We have to become, you know, more comfortable knowing that this virus is going to be among us for a while, but we really need to get some structure in place. And the only way we're going to have structure to put an effective plan forward is to have everyone have to do rapid tests, period. So if it costs $1, then they should be able to make profit off of it, right? They made it. They should make a profit.
Okay.
But it shouldn't be, you know, $15 per test, because that makes it prohibitive for people to want to take on a daily or even a weekly basis. But if you tell people, look, one, it's going to be free because the government is paying for it for a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You know, we can create a structure where it becomes affordable for everyone over, let's say, a two-year period, and the government just uses it. The government pays the price and gives people the tools to say, all right, I'm going to do my test, I'm going to, you know, register the results, and be done. I think that's
okay.
A simple way to solve this COVID problem is to give everybody access to tests so we can know where the virus is in real time.
All right, that makes a lot of sense. What do we do though? Is there anything else that causes people not to get inoculated? Because the vaccine is free. There were things that we didn't know about the inoculation in the past. They say that men are more susceptible to get an enlarged heart after they get inoculated, predominantly more so than it occurs with women. But I don't know if it causes the heart to stay enlarged or it shrinks back to its normal size thereafter. And I haven't really looked into it any further, because I took the inoculation and
right.
I've got so many issues. You know, I didn't want to take a chance. I figured that was the only thing. But how do we ameliorate all these concerns? And why don't we know this from the CDC? Why don't they tell us this to warn us in advance?
Our trust. A lot of people don't trust the CDC because, you know, their recommendations have been contradictory. And
correct.
You know, even with this virus, it's like, you know, you get vaccinated, but you still have to wear a mask. Or, you know, if you don't get vaccinated, then you have to, you know, wear a mask or you can't go eat at a restaurant in New York City. I mean, like, you have all these different rules that are, you know, conflicting and you know, hurting people in their ability to earn or their ability to enjoy. And that's why I say, like, look, if the people that are not vaccinated are going to say, I'm not doing it, I don't care, let's just draw a bright line.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's it. And that's what President Biden did this week. He said, look, enough's enough. Rapid tests must be free to anyone and everyone that wants it. And that's the first start. Now the government has to follow up that directive with, we need to figure out how to make sure we get it into the hands of each family so they have access to these rapid tests more frequently.
Okay.
And even if they have to do it, let's say we have to do it for 2 months, all right? 2 months.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
That's 60 days. I'm more than confident that you're going to have adoption of that by the areas where COVID, Omicron, right, is out of control.
Mm-hmm.
Say for 60
mm-hmm.
days in this area of the country, we're going to make sure that every household has access to a COVID rapid test on a daily basis so they can determine what's going on. And these tests,
mm-hmm.
by the way, are smart enough to, on their own, register the results of that test to whatever database you need it registered to. It doesn't have to be the button. Yeah, the technology is there. I mean, you have driverless cars from Walmart already. Like, think about it. You have these things in place. We need to stop overthinking it and just use what's around us and be done. And that's my issue with respect to some of these bureaucrats that have the power to really contain and control COVID. They're not using their power effectively, and they're not managing the situation properly. But we finally got right approach with rapid testing. And that's why I keep coming back to it. Like, I just don't understand why they won't do it, and they finally did it. So I thank President Biden for taking that step and making it a directive for rapid testing to be available to everyone.
Well, one thing that's interesting, Europe is maybe a bit more, excuse the term, draconian, end quote, when it comes to testing and stuff like that. They're demanding that people get tested and inoculated. And if they're not, for example, in Greece, I hear that people who are 60 plus are going to lose part of their pension. So they're going to take out $130 a month out of their pension. I think their pension's about $650.
Okay.
So they're going to take out $130 if they don't get inoculated.
Well,
and then they're,
so they calculated the cost, right? They're saying it's
yes,
going to be
did.
A on their system, and they said, this is what it's going to cost if you have to, you know, go to the hospital or need some medical care because you chose not to, you know, inoculate yourself, right? This is their position.
Mm-hmm.
They quantified $130. That's it. There's a cost for everything, and that's why I'm pointing out the right step to deal with first the crisis is rapid testing. You have to pay for those tests. The private industry is not just going to say, fine, I'm going to let go of my profit of, you know, $10 a cart. You know, they're rightfully making money, as they should. But the government has to say, for a short period of time, we need it at this price because we need to get control. After we get control and we develop our protocols and our plans and people get into the habit of doing these tests and reliably doing them, not, you know, I do it one day and then I skip a day. And, you know, they do it reliably.
Yeah.
So we can just,
okay,
for a short period of time, say, all right, this is where it is and this is where it's going and this is how we're going to deal with it so that it doesn't cause more havoc. That's it. That's all we need to do is get the right information.
Well,
it's possible.
Okay, but if we do it, let's say, for 2 months, what happens after 2 months? Because this is going to continue on and on. There were other places in Europe, for example, where they said if you don't get inoculated, you can't use the buses, you can't use the trains, you can't even go to a restaurant. You can't go to a event. You can't go to a movie theater. You can go to shop for food, and that's about it. So that's going to cost people, or maybe I don't know if it's going to entice them to get inoculated or not. And then there are other places that are saying, if you get sick and you were never inoculated, we're not going to pay for your medical care. Tough. In other words, we don't want to hear from you if you get sick and you never got inoculated. We can't impose things like that here in the United States. Are those credible, conduct or demands from government?
You know, I was having a similar conversation with my wife the other day about, you know, the situation at the Supreme Court.
She's a smart lady.
Yeah, incredibly bright and much more intelligent than I am.
And better looking, I hear.
Way better. that she and I were discussing the abortion situation in front of the Supreme Court, and it's like it's such a contradiction where you have exactly what you described. You know, you have people on the right saying you cannot abort life. You can't, you know, women cannot choose, even if it's for their own health. But yet when those lives are born, they're born into a situation where they don't have help. And it's like,
right.
So they're born into that situation. That situation already is here. So it's kind of contradictory that, you know, you don't want people to not, you don't want them to get an abortion. Don't do it. But then you don't want to support them if the life comes. So
they're demanding. Actually, they're demanding that you don't get an abortion,
correct?
And that you don't have a right to that. And even if it was caused by incest or rape, and the point is that so if they get impregnated in that process, they don't want to hear about it. You can't get an abortion, and then you have to suffer the consequences of being violated when it was unwanted. And even if it is wanted, the point is you don't want to have a child. It was never intention to have a child. Why don't we give people, some sort of way to make sure that they don't get impregnated, no matter what the reason is? Maybe they want to welcome having a sexual relationship with somebody, but they don't want to have a baby.
Well,
now, who's going to raise the baby? There's no money.
Right.
And it impoverishes the woman forever and ever. She'll never get out of it.
And that's
20 years to raise a child.
That's the problem. And that's why it's such a contradiction that we're dealing with. And this is why society needs to just, you know, take a step back and say, you know, if we believe in individual rights, we need to respect mm-hmm. individual rights, and we need to support individual rights. So you can't have it both ways like it is right now. They don't want an abortion. They want the life to have a right to life.
Right.
And they need to support that life. And that's where the failure comes. So I think, you know, to not get, you know, too far into this issue, I just wanna put some big bright lines around it, because it still applies to the COVID vaccine situation where, you know,
uh-huh.
you don't want it. So fine, you don't want it, then test daily like you're being described. But also, if mm-hmm. you're going to do that rapid test and you're going to have reliable results, then guess what? You should be able to go eat at a restaurant. If you tested negative and you can play, you know, in the NBA or you can play in the NFL because they're doing their COVID protocols, then you should be able to go eat at a restaurant in New York City. You should be able to work, you know, be it as a firefighter or police or an EMS worker.
But don't you need documentation to do that? What's so difficult about getting the documentation to prove it? I've got a card. What's so difficult about getting the validation to prove that you've been vaccinated or that you had COVID, whatever variant you had, you overcame it, you took the test to prove it, and you have the documentation to prove that. Why is that so difficult for people to have?
No. I'm not saying that the documentation is a problem. I'm saying if people are not vaccinated and uh-huh. they have a rapid test, they should be able to use right. the results from that rapid test to go to the restaurant or to show their
right.
employees that they
Well, don't
are,
they have that right? Don't they have the right to do that if they can prove that they had the rapid test and they're free?
But that's what I'm saying. So the new move on making rapid tests more available is very important.
Uh-huh.
And it just needs to be a stronger strategy to make sure that the results of those rapid tests inform a plan to contain the new Omicron variant.
Except that it's talk. How do you impose where people, let's say, once a week take the rapid test, which is paid for by the government, and at the same time, how will you get that information to a source in government that can oversee and they know that you or your wife or your children took the inoculation? I took the inoculation and I could prove it to the government that I didn't forget to do it on Sunday.
All right, so here we go. And this is my point. You know, we have enough technology to have driverless cars. We have enough technology to have
right.
Google, Alexa in your home. You have enough technology on your smartphone to predict what, you know, you're going to buy and do next. I think
right.
there needs to be an emergency meeting with all these tech companies and government and distributors in the private sector. There needs to be a coming of minds, even with the military,
mm-hmm.
say, look, we're going to do this in this area. We're going to start in a small area, and then we're going to scale out. And if they're
okay.
able to, they know where these cases are. I mean, right now they're in upstate New York. Okay, so draw the circle and say this is where we're going to do it, and just do it on a very limited scale. We did it in New Rochelle when COVID first hit New Rochelle. So the response of capability is there. We just have to do it, and that's where
we don't have much time anymore. You know, I read that.
But that's why they acted
New
now.
York,
that's applauding the president for making this directive because it is the right thing.
You know what? I mean, I respect the president, but I haven't seen him follow through on a lot of things, and he's a laggard on many, many levels. And he talked a good game, but he hasn't produced on every level. So
let's see
I'm
what he does now.
Succeed.
That brings me to January 6th, by the way, because I'm curious about what's going to happen in Congress, because it looks like, you know, the House is going to go to the Republicans next year in the next election cycle. And
it seems like it.
Looks pretty close that the Senate may go red again. So
mm-hmm.
my concern is, you're right. What is the president going to do if he loses the House and the Senate? So something must be done now. Something must happen immediately to make sure that, you know, be it first, the people of America need to be protected and supported. But from a political standpoint, he needs to make sure that that translates into support for his agenda at the polls. Mm-hmm. And right now, like you said, the perception is his team is not doing enough, and it may be too little too late.
It may just be. Hopefully not, because the nation needs a very strong and focused leader. So whether you like a Democrat or not, the point is we hope that they're going to do what's good for the nation, whoever they happen to be, Republican or Democrat or who knows what. So very interesting. One thing that I learned about upstate New York, they are so inundated with people who have come down with COVID. Just last week, they reported it, that they once they took care of people in the ICU, in the intermediate care units, and people had to wait maybe 12 hours, even 24 hours to be able to see a doctor in the ICU. And once they were able to get, I guess healthier, they needed to send them to a nursing home. They couldn't find a nursing home in upstate New York. The closest place they could find a nursing home for these patients was in New York City. We're very lucky to have New York City here, because then if you can't get a place even in Westchester County, you can come to New York City. But that's going to end as well. What are we going to do about this? We're overwhelmed.
So all right. we are overwhelmed, and I think what we need to deal with is the issue at hand. And this is why we need, you know, great information so the best decisions can be made. Good input, mm-hmm. good output. And this is where I believe with Governor Hochul's move to activate the National Guard in upstate New York is the right move. It starts that process of gathering the information. And now it's a challenge for, you know, the contact tracers that they're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on. And I'm laughing because it's like, you know, contact tracers are people like, you know, they're regular people behind a telephone making phone calls trying to find people. But again, right. I recognize that the trust and the lack of confidence in the system that we have is very, very, very low. But we have. So the hope is, you know, people are wearing their masks. The hope is people will get vaccinated and boosted. The hope
but they're
is,
not. You know, I don't know, when you walk the streets, I see people wearing their mask under their nose. So that's pointless. Why are you doing that? Or they wear a mask and they put it right under their chin. And I don't know why they even have a mask. And that's probably one of the safest things you can do is to wear a mask, because you never know, you can somebody that you're going to be passing by or close to for whatever reason, they may have a variant and you can be susceptible to it.
And that's
because
why
we don't
even
know yet.
As
the inoculations that we already have are going to protect us.
Former members of the Trump administration said, wear a mask. That's probably our best defense against this until vaccines catch up. But just to you know, put a you know, an endpoint on this, you know, and, you know, we got rapid tests coming. The government hopefully will gather the right, you know, collection of folks to implement the plan to hope to contain this and just work a strategy to make sure that it remains contained until we can get a better plan in place to really end COVID. It looks like history's repeating itself. 1918 Spanish flu. We now have the virus that came from China here. It's going on 3 years now, right? So maybe in another year and a half, 2 years, this will officially be behind us if history is to teach us anything.
Well, you know what's very interesting? I spoke to an associate of mine who penned an article. I haven't seen it yet, but it's about the flu vaccine.
Yeah.
So they suggest that people take the flu vaccine every year. Do you know what the efficacy rate is of the flu vaccine as opposed to, let's say, the inoculation that you get for coronavirus? Certainly the original mutations that we had.
What's the
efficacy is supposed to be really quite high in the initial COVID-19 things that we started to get inoculations for. But do you know what the results were for the flu?
No.
Any clue? 39% effectiveness. 39%.
Wow.
The article will be up by the end of the day today.
Wow, God.
I was blown away. And isn't that one of the problems to our CDC, even though I respect Fauci, his language equivocates. And the words are so poorly constructed.
Go all over the place. And that's the problem. It's like you keep coming out with these directives and conflicting information, and then, you know, as a doctor, you know, it's just – and that's why, you know, I think there's a huge swath of the country that really appreciates former President Trump because, you know, he called BS BS, and he told mm-hmm. people, you know, what he believed in and what he felt, and that's what proves to be at this point correct. And if you look at the immigration situation where President Biden now reinstated the Trump policy of remain in Mexico,
yep.
you know,
mm-hmm.
he campaigned on, oh, this is terrible, and then
right.
when he realized, you know, the response that America had up until that point was actually the problem, he reinstated the Trump policy. And then, you know, as a member of the black community, you know, I will say, like, you know, I am deeply disappointed that that was his first thing that he did in office, was to deal with people that cannot even vote for him. Like, you have so many members of the black community that need help. And, you know, out of the various budgets that were passed, monies up to 50, I think it was like $40 billion for HBCUs were cut. Like, come on. Like,
mm-hmm.
how do you allow that
mm-hmm.
to happen to a community that supported you and got you over the top? Like, you got to support who supported you. And that's one of the things with this January 6th investigation that, you know, I find very interesting because, you know, look, there definitely was some sort of collaboration and coordination. There's definitely
mm-hmm.
a sorts at work that was working to try and, you know, use whatever process was available to them to overturn the general election. And that happened.
Right.
And those people that, you know, basically were motivated by treason need to be held accountable for their treacherous acts. However,
mm-hmm.
we step back and look at it and say, wait a minute, well, look at the decisions that were made and look at the consequences of this. You know, these people were patriots. Now you have a real argument going on between were they really patriots or were they traitors? And that's why I'm looking at this January 6th conversation as, you know, what's really happening, especially now that Mark Meadows released a book and Mark Meadows is going to be commenting on anything and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, either A, benefit for himself, or B, you know, tell the truth. So I'm hoping that we can get the truth in the January 6th situation because right now the way I see it is, you know, Trump has been right. And I don't say that proudly. I say
you're 100% right, but that's the question. Have we lost a sense of decorum in the way we conduct our politics? Or are we now entrenched in this adversarial position? If you're a Republican, we hate your guts. If you're a Democrat, we hate your guts. And if you're on one side, you're to be dismissed. And if you're on the other side, you're to be dismissed. We don't have a sense of decorum in how we conduct our discussion. You know, they don't have a relationship like we have where I respect what you have to say. And if I don't, I'll tell you, and then you'll tell me why I'm wrong. We don't have that in politics anymore. We've lost our way.
So this is so important. This is like a profound point, and I hope everybody picks up what we're putting down here because that is the biggest problem. We do not know how to talk to each other. And, you know, I've stepped up my involvement with my son and my daughter, especially on their devices, because they have like little chat rooms and they use emojis and they have a whole different language. So I'm
correct.
Working with my children now to say, look, you know, you cannot be, in, you know, completely disrespectful online. And it's hard, right? Because, you know, people hide behind these screen names and stuff like that. But, you know, you have
right.
to know that there's reality outside, that if you get into the habit of being so mean and so nasty or, you know, sending crazy things out, if you do that in the real world, there may be a different reception of that message, and it could get you hurt. So you have to, you know,
correct.
Use different methods, like sports. You know, I have my kids in sports, and I'm using that as a method to teach them different types of values, skills, and also practice their ability to, you know, become better people. And that's where you're right. A lot of people don't apply all the lessons they learned from their grandparents, lessons they learned from sports, lessons they learned from, you know, their teachers that they grew up with. They need
right.
to that. We need to channel that in our politics, and that's why, you know, I'm so passionate about politics, because I recognize the profound impact we can have on people's lives. And if we can just, you know, not be so emotional about certain situations. Yeah, I said Trump was right, but he was wrong on so many other things. But as a Democrat,
oh, yeah. Well, but
as
you
a
gotta
mayor,
give him credit where he was right, and you can give him demerits where he was wrong.
But who's
100% right? And who's 100% wrong?
I have a concern with these justice Democrats. I have a concern with these democratic socialists that have no margin for conversation. There's no compromise.
Hmm.
And that creates right. a situation where you create co-annihilation. And Martin Luther King,
mm-hmm.
Dr. Martin Luther King, he warned against that. And that's why I'm saying,
yeah.
look, we need to deal with this stuff. And as I look at, you know, not being able to have a conversation, I'm looking at the governor's race right now. And how people are going to now start, you know, picking sides and having conversations about, well, I'm with this group versus that group, and it's really,
yeah.
you know, it's unfortunate, but I look forward to that conversation, because, you know, real questions need to be asked of the Attorney General, who, you know, is politically targeting enemies to clear the field so she can run for governor, and you know, and you look at, you know, the situation with former Governor Cuomo and how it hurt
mm-hmm.
his brother Chris Cuomo at CNN. I mean, you got so many things. I mean, look, I'm not excusing the former governor's conduct based on the reports that came out about his activity and how that's
right.
under investigation, all that stuff. I'm not, you know, condoning anything that happened or may have happened or whatever, however you want to frame it. I'm
right.
just saying that there's a level of toxicity in politics that really needs to never, ever enter the equation, but it unfortunately dominates it because, you know, people get carried away with their emotions on this stuff. So I'm hoping that,
you know when it comes to this whole dynamic between women and men, men and women, we need to start to teach both the men and the women how to conduct and engage in relationships, because evidently we don't. And
yep.
there's got to be a way where people feel secure enough to say, hey, I don't want your attention. It's not welcome. You pull that crap with me one more time, and I'm out of here.
Yep.
And why don't we do that? Is it all about money? Is that the driving force?
It's about self-control. It's about dominance. It's about power. I mean, and that's why, you know, you have so many examples of abusive power. And you have so many examples of injustice. It's because
yeah.
people in the system, when they're in their positions of power, they want to protect their position of power. And when I look at the situation of what happened at Columbia University, where for years they denied the wrongdoing of an OBGYN, and now
yeah.
today uses Columbia Medical School or whatever it was, settled $72
mm-hmm.
million payment with the victims of this, you know, horrendous, horrific.
Right.
And the same thing
mm-hmm.
goes, you know, doctors Larry Nassar, right? For years, the
yeah,
gymnastics,
yeah.
they covered it up.
Gymnastics.
They concealed it.
God.
And this is the problem.
Yeah.
Like, these people that had the obligation to confront this issue, they were benefiting from the situation.
But why don't we teach girls, for example, in this particular case with Nassar, why don't we teach them what a violation is? Why are they embarrassed to tell their parents what happened? And why is that? Why don't we engage our young people to tell us what's going on? Look at what happened in the churches with children getting molested. Hey, it happened in synagogues too. Doesn't matter. People are frail, and they do that.
This is why it's important for people to realize that there are people like you, there are people like me that are going to speak up on their behalf. Because wrongs do happen to good people. Bad things happen to good people all the time. And what, you know, I'm so proud of for these victims, victims of Nassar, victims, you know, that were abused in the church, victims were abused, you know, at the hands of, you know, this former Columbia doctor, you know,
right.
I hope they find some solace in the fact that they fought back and they went through that long, difficult journey of being, you know, told that they were lying and they weren't telling the truth and, you know, it never happened. Like, that hurts. It really hurts people and it impacts their ability to function. And that's why I'm so, you know, passionate about making sure when people are wronged, we work to get it right. And we have to use our voices.
Absolutely.
To help these people.
Well, it
you
was
know.
Very interesting. There was a recent case about a woman who is a tennis player, if I remember correctly. She's from China. I don't know what a doubles player is, but I guess there are two people on one team and two people on the other. But whatever the case is, she was molested, or she alleged that somebody molested her from the Chinese government. And so she was abused physically, and she pulled out from the team or something. But then the World Tennis Association, they came out in search for her. They wanted to get an interview with her through the internet, and they did. Some people think she's okay. Other people don't. But the point is, the world is standing behind her, which I have never seen before. But she said enough is enough, and I don't want to be molested.
We need more of, and that's where transparency is the real antidote. You know, shining a light in dark areas is always the answer to, you know, cast out that darkness. And that's why when you look at the situation with respect to Governor Cuomo and how, you know, the process is unfolding both politically and policy-wise, you can see very clearly that there's a lot going on. And I want to slow down a few moving parts before we run out of complete time. We have about 3 minutes.
Go ahead.
I want to point out is if you look at – so the news today was that Governor Cuomo now has a new attorney to defend him in front of a Department of Justice inquiry into some of his actions. And this is a new set of lawyers. And I just want to point out that, you know, the lawyer that he has is my former lawyer who I had a falling out with because I felt that politically and policy-wise, he wasn't doing, you know, the right things in representing me when, you know, I was attacked by the various forces out there. And as I've always said, I've always said and maintained that this was about the governor's race in 2022, because they didn't want a young, black, smart, married man that, you know, is in love, head over heels with his wife and children, and turned around a city, making it truly rival. They didn't want that on the field. They want political hacks, and they want people that are, in my opinion, sexually frustrated, because that's what they all are. And when you really look carefully at some of these candidates, you know, look at their family structure, right? Ask those questions, like, who are they really?
Yeah.
And when you look and see that their integrity at home is really a cause of concern, you really learn something about people, about how they operate and how they set people up to take them down so they can try and look like they're a fresh bunch of roses, but they're not. So I say that broadly speaking because that's what politics has become. It's become this cast of characters that are only in it for themselves. And that's what frustrates me most because, you know, here I am, a regular guy from the south side of Mount Vernon, grew up a hard life, but with a lot of hope that we could get it right to help people not, you know, get caught up in the system, not experience injustice, you know, have an opportunity to achieve and seize the American dream. Those are things that are possible, especially when you use your power appropriately. But again,
okay, we got to go because we got less than 5 seconds left. So
did it? It was done.
I can't wait till next week. We got to take this back up.
That Cuomo is being treated far different than I was treated, and the same thing goes for Mayor Bill de Blasio and some of the others out there that you know, some real issues that they're dealing with, or you know, I just, you know, look, injustice is injustice. So speaking from a personal standpoint, I think people can see politics at work, and I'm very thankful to the people of Mount Vernon to continue to reach out to me and support me, and I'm looking forward to being very active in this upcoming governor's race.
Okay, well, we may be cut off, so just have a great weekend. All the best to you and the family. Take care. Thank you so much. Bye.